Good evening, friends. This is your host on Valley Writers Read, Franz Weinschenk, welcoming you to another edition of our program, which features only stories written by Valley residents. And tonight, several really provocative stories by two retirees, Jacqueline and Ed Hibbler. Now, as far as Ed Hibbler is concerned, I am truly sorry to report that since this couple recorded their stories, Ed unfortunately has passed away. The stories we're going to hear are about a couple who, after a lifetime of working, thought they had their financial situation all taken care of, but because of some really bad luck, lost all their money, and now, at advanced ages, had to go out and find new jobs and try to put together a totally new life for themselves. Here they are, Jacqueline and Ed Hibbler, reading excerpts from their book entitled, Oh, Those Gutsy Geezers.
Oh, those gutsy geezers. Most of us expect, as we mature and grow older, to have achieved a certain degree of financial success, so that when we must retire, we'll have more than just enough resources to survive. We both certainly expected to do exactly that. Most of our friends in our age group had achieved comfortable levels of retirement income when it came time for them to leave their regular jobs and reorganize their lives as seniors. We expected no less. Our plans were simple. We'd sell our large, custom-built suburban home, move to a smaller home at much lower cost, invest the difference, and travel. Well, our story here begins when this assumption for us went completely awry, and we found ourselves at ages 70 and 60, respectively, facing absolute financial ruin, and with relentlessly advancing age, no known way to recover the staggering loss. Our problem took us over 4 years to resolve. It meant leaving our home, family, and friends, and moving into a surreal world of privilege that few of us ever encounter. As I mentioned to Ed after we first decided to try this extraordinary adventure, I always thought that by the time I reached this age, I'd have a cleaning lady, not be one. What follows is but a small part of our story. All characters and locations and experiences are based on real people and events, but to protect their privacy, locales and names have been changed. Our story begins with a three-month stint as co-managers of a very large and posh new retirement residence for well-to-do retirees in the North Bay area, which in the book we dubbed Lingerwood. Our experiences here were in themselves mind-boggling, but in less than 3 months, I broke my leg when I fell carrying a tray of food upstairs to an ill resident, and we were forced to return home for a 9 months recovery period before beginning new adventures working for three ultra-wealthy families in the Napa area.
Our first assignment was in the palatial Bay Area home of Mrs. Lorraine Kandahar. She was CEO of a nationally known retail antique and home furnishing chain. She'd been in her own successful business for more than 50 years and had become a fixture in local politics and philanthropic endeavors. It was also rumored that in her earlier years she'd been a madam in a local luxurious house of joy. Her customers of that youthful time were reported to have been from the city's elite, with, it was said, even some of the local clergy blessing her establishment. Profits from this fleshy endeavor apparently were the foundation of her now legendary retail success. Well, Jackie and I met Lorraine, whom we later dubbed Lulu, in an interview in her sumptuous downtown office. Now, Lulu was scarcely 5 feet tall, with neatly coiffed snow-white hair, very thick and enormous tortoiseshell glasses, and a skin-tight dress which, with her hair, made her look like a giant upholstered ice cream cone. We noted during our interview with her that employees who came by her office during our visit seemed to be quite intimidated by her. She was looking, she said, in her rasping, fractured trombone voice, for a reliable couple to manage her home and its surroundings. It sat atop the Berkeley Hills with panoramic views, she said, of the entire Bay and San Francisco area, clear out to the Farallon Islands well beyond the Golden Gate. I would drive her and her husband, a tiny owl-like cigar-smoking man we later dubbed Burnsy because he looked like a shrunken actor George Burns, to work every morning in their huge stretch Cadillac limousine. I do household shopping, take care of the lush plantings and lawns around the large gated mansion, and act as butler for evening meals. Jackie would, as she said, only have the house to care for and just two meals to prepare. And because, as she said, she never had any children, we'd be just like her family. Little did we know. After looking over the area and being under merciless financial pressure, with debts relentlessly accumulating on two homes, after returning home, we accepted the job almost exactly a year after our ill-fated Lingerwood experiences began.
One memorable afternoon, after we'd been on the job only a week or so, after a barrage of critical phone calls from her office, I got a friendly call from our old friends Joan and Bob, the couple who had gotten us into this lifestyle originally. They were now living and working on jobs similar to ours and weren't very far away. I mentioned to Joan that Lulu had ordered me to prepare a fillet of sole dinner for that night and that she insisted she didn't want butter used, but that the fish must be delicate and brown. Well, because Joan Cordon Bleu trained, fortunately had that day off, and was experienced in every kind of gourmet cooking, she said she'd be glad to come over and give me a hand. Once she arrived, the two of us prepared a lovely dinner. However, I didn't know how I could get the fish delicate and brown without using butter, but she said, oh, it's easy, just lie a little, and you have to use a little butter anyway, and then pepper it with paprika. It'll be golden brown, and she won't know the difference. She then proceeded to dredge the fish in butter. We also found what appeared to be paprika in a plastic baggie and dusted it thoroughly over each fillet. Well, Joan left just before Ed took the big limo into town to pick up Lulu and Burnsy. Soon I had the dinner prepared to the point where Ed was ready to serve their highnesses in their palatial, glassed-in TV solarium. Two pieces of nicely browned sole with parsley and accompanying vegetables and pilaf were arranged on each plate. Ed headed for the solarium throne room, towel properly draped over one arm. As he said, it's the way he'd seen it done in the movies. Well, he'd gotten almost to the solarium door with news anchor Dan Rather booming out of the TV when I raced out of the kitchen and caught his arm. Good grief, stop, I hissed. Don't give them the fish. Give me that, quick. I grabbed both plates off his tray and I scampered back to the kitchen. Fortunately, Lulu and Burnsy were focused on the booming TV and hadn't seen us. Ed followed me back to the kitchen to see what was wrong. I whispered to him that I'd just tasted a tiny piece of the fish as he was leaving the kitchen and it nearly melted my mouth. What Joan and I thought was paprika was cayenne pepper. Well, I frantically tried to swab off the pepper and refry the mess into something recognizable, but it just kind of dissolved into goo. Well, fortunately, I was able to replace the loss with extra pieces I'd saved for myself and Ed while he went out to apologize for the delay in serving dinner. What's wrong out there? I'm hungry, growled Lulu. Well, nothing serious, Ed lied. The sole's taking a little special preparation. I'm sure you'll love it. And they did. We then received a rare compliment. Oh, damn good sole, Lulu mumbled. Loved it. Proves you don't need butter to get it nice and brown. But things were not developing as we had been told when we were hired. What had happened to that you'll be just like my family routine? After the first 3 weeks during the summer without one day off, I finally asked Lulu, which days might we have off? Time off, Lulu snapped. You'll get time off in December when we go to Switzerland for our lamb embryo injections. There's too much work for you to take any time off now. Your job is to be here when we need you, she whined. When we're gone, you can have time off. Of course, you'll still have to stay around to take care of Lovable. Lovable was her miserable, tiny Yorkshire terrier who screeched and howled in the back of the stretch limo every time we went around a corner. Just who did this arrogant woman think she was? A stunning phone call the next day gave us some idea. The caller, with a thick foreign accent, asked if we were the new housekeepers for Mrs. Kandahar. When I answered yes, the caller said, you get out of there quick. Get out now. That woman is crazy, and she make you crazy, too. But before we got out, We had one more memorable experience with food and Lulu, which was really wild.
When I came in from working in the yard that afternoon, Jackie said, "Lulu just called and she wants barbecued chicken for her dinner tonight. Oh, and she wants you to use that big new contraption she has on the deck outside the kitchen. No sense in having that expensive equipment if you don't use it," she'd bawled. "Well, I'd done a lot of barbecuing at home on our own simple round Weber, but this new machine with all kinds of electronic automatic bells and whistles, well, I was very uneasy with the idea." "Why me?" I asked Jackie. "You're the cook." "Well, I don't know a dumb thing about the barbecue, especially one with all that electronic stuff on it. It's your baby, dear. Better get out there pronto and fire it up," she replied. Well, I muttered something under my breath, but went out to check on the new electronic marvel. It was now nearly 5 o'clock, and they wanted dinner at 6, so Jackie began to put together the vegetables and dessert and brought out to me the cut-up pieces of 2 chickens with some barbecue sauce. "Here's your stuff, dear," she said, handing me the pan as she looked at the now hot barbecue. She commented, "With all those gadgets, I ought to create something fabulous." "Yeah, it'll be fabulous, all right," I muttered, as I put on an apron and turned to get the chicken underway. But Jackie went back into the kitchen to finish preparing the vegetables and the rest of the dinner. It was now nearly 6 o'clock. "Geez, the whole damn thing's on fire," I suddenly bellowed. "Jackie, get that kitchen fire extinguisher out here. It's in the broom closet. Quick!" As she raced to the door by the deck, I saw clouds of smoke and flames billowing out of the machine, and then turned to the broom closet for the extinguisher. She leaped out the door and handed it to me. I immediately pulled the ring plug on the gadget, and a cloud of white smoke poured out of it all over the flaming chicken and machine. "My God, Ed, what happened?" Jackie shouted as the cremated fowl continued to smolder and sizzle. "Well, I'm damned if I know," I growled. "It just suddenly exploded all over the place. I'm lucky I didn't get cremated myself. Now what the hell are we going to give their highnesses for dinner?" Well, Jackie shrugged and then took barbecue tongs and picked off the still-sizzling machine all of the recognizable pieces of chicken she could find. She put them back in the same pan and hurried into the kitchen. "Wait here," she said. "I'll be right back with a solution for this mess. But you better clean up that machine before you go get them." So she went to the sink and, using an emery board, laboriously scraped as much of the char and any fire retardant off the meat as she could, then smeared each piece with a thick overdose of heavy barbecue sauce. She then reheated the whole mess in the kitchen oven. Well, it certainly looked yucky, but we had told Lulu and Bernsey that we had conjured up something really special on their new barbecue, and I was sure they'd love it. Well, I went out to the limo, drove into town, and fetched the two, and again they confounded us after they'd had their dinner. "Ed, you're another Wolfgang Puck. Best damn chicken I ever ate," said Lulu, mumbling through her barbecue sauce. "Give me a recipe for that sauce. Damn, that was good. I want to give it to my office help." Bernsey, nodding in agreement, gummed away on a gooey drumstick, muttering unintelligibly. You know, some people have Neanderthal tastes. Within the next 2 weeks, we had been through more repugnant adventures with these two, more endless hours of Lulu's high-handed impossible demands. We finally gave her notice and left for new adventures elsewhere.
Several days before leaving Lulu's kooky nest, we had seen 2 new ads in local papers, and another came from friend Joan, all asking for a couple to manage estate property in the North Bay area. Joan sounded more interesting. The day before we left Lulu and Bernsey, we called the advertising party for an appointment the following Monday. The plush 500-acre layout was located on a broad mountainside above the Alexander Valley, another wine-growing area well north of Napa and St. Helena. Interviewing us was a middle-aged, slightly built, dark, handsome man, swarthy with a mustache, seemingly of Middle Eastern or Southern European ethnic origin. He introduced himself as Mr. Amand and described himself as a commercial real estate and manufacturing entrepreneur with international connections. He was dressed in an immaculate white linen suit with ascot tie and white casual shoes. We met in his spacious ranch house living room, noting that he appeared brusque in manner and seemed to relish using an unblinkingly steely stare to face down others. Noting that Ed was a retired professor, he revealed that he was himself American University educated. He spoke flawless English with a barely discernible accent. We found later that he was clearly used to dominating any group. He immensely enjoyed playing the gracious host at elegant house and lawn parties thrown periodically for the international set of the Bay Area. He called ambassadors and other big wheels by their first names and loved to charm the ladies with his continental hand-kissing manners. He also apparently had mysterious connections with many politically powerful figures in other countries where he had large business property holdings. We later became aware that many phone calls came to this ranch house, often in the wee hours of the night, indicating that they probably had originated halfway around the world. Then we discovered that there'd been two unsuccessful apparent attempts on his life, both drive-by shootings, possibly by either overseas business competitors or thugs with political connections to his enemies. One long-range rifle shot went through his bedroom window. Rumor had it that guns hired by Middle Eastern operatives were out to get him. Our most chilling discovery later was that a year or so earlier, one of his ranch workers had been shot dead, with his body hung from a large oak tree on the ranch, an enigmatic note pinned on his clothing. We were soon to dub him Sin Bed, with a hyphen deliberate. Sin Bed, we discovered, was usually on the property only during weekends. But ah, those weekends.
Our new home was to be in a tiny one-bedroom cottage adjacent to the big ranch house. Our duties were the usual for a caretaker-manager couple. By this time, Jackie had no cooking to do, just care of the big sprawling house and help with the large lawn and house parties that Sinbad liked to throw periodically. The sprawling one-story house itself was comfortably furnished with leather ranch-style sofa and lounge chairs. Floors were heavy bronze, Spanish-tiled, and prints of hunting scenes and other landscapes, some of them clearly from Middle Eastern countries, hung on wood planking walls. A massive fieldstone fireplace dominated one wall of the living room. Two wings of tastefully furnished bedrooms with adjoining baths extended from both sides of the main house, virtually surrounding a very large swimming pool. My work was to maintain four tennis courts, keep the spacious lawns mowed and trimmed, service the large pool, prune fruit trees, and seasonally replant and fertilize flowers, bulbs, and shrubs as needed around the place. And we also was to make sure that guests, especially female, were properly ensconced in the comfortable quarters near the pool. Well, a week or so after our arrival at the ranch, Sinbad had taken me into town to buy a small four-wheel drive pickup truck, which I had advised him we needed. While in town, he also took me to a big sporting goods store, briefly asked my opinion about deer rifles, and proceeded to buy a new 30-30 caliber carbine and a truck gun rack to carry it in. I was to install it in the new truck, he said. When I asked him what it was for, he said he'd been having trouble with what he called outsiders on the ranch recently, and he wanted me to set up a patrol with the truck on an irregular schedule and report anything I saw that was unusual. He also mentioned that he had no confidence whatever in local police and warned me never to call them. He wished to handle all such problems himself, he said. Well, I told Jackie at bedtime about my day with the new pickup, the rifle and the gun rack, and Sinbad's strange behavior. Our minds raced. Just what did he fear? How come he was getting us involved in what should be a police matter? All of the earlier rumors we'd heard about him and those ugly ranch happenings suddenly swirled back into awareness. The next morning, he called me into his walnut-paneled office. It was decorated with English golfing scenes and other pictures taken from around the world. A number of framed testimonials and plaques, some of them apparently in Arabic, also were evident. He also asked me to sit down across from his desk. Eddie said in his customary brusque manner, "As you know, I'm away from this place most of the week." He then got up, apparently thinking carefully what he wanted to say. He walked over to a window overlooking the broad valley below, now darkening in the early dusk. Lights from the nearby city were beginning to wink on. He turned and gave me another of his patented stares. He said, "There's one other thing you and Jackie should be aware of." "Oh," I queried, "what might that be?" "Well, Ed, I have a very dear lady friend who visits me out here occasionally, and I want you both to meet her and become acquainted. You'll find this lady friendly and helpful at times when I may not be around or available. Her name is Miss Ada Longstreet." Because she's here so frequently, I maintain a special wing of the house for her exclusive use. I want you to tell Jackie to pay special attention to that part of the house and keep it neat and immaculate at all times. He then paused and gave me an especially direct stare. It's critical there be nothing left in her quarters after she leaves, which might be found by others. No hairpins, curlers, or, you know, women's things. Do you understand? His voice was stern and cold. Well, I nodded as I began for the first time to see what kind of a relationship our long-married employer really had going on here. I then asked, "Sir, would you mind telling me just what or what it is you feel threatened by? Why you think we need an armed guard patrolling this place? I really..." He interrupted me abruptly, saying, "Yes, I do mind. All you need to know is to keep a sharp eye out for trespassers and use your CB radio in the truck to call the house. I repeat, I do not want you ever to call the police. I don't want them fooling around my property. I have no respect for them, whatever. That's all, Ed. I'll see you in the morning." Well, neither of us slept very well that night.
The next morning was interrupted with a strange phone call from a man with a basso profundo voice and a thick accent. He asked for Sinbad, who this morning was already in the city at his office. I told the caller that he wasn't available, that he could probably be reached at his office. The caller, clearly in an ugly mood, snarled that he'd already called him there and he wasn't there. Then in that thick accent he warned, "Tell that son of a bitch she better be at the meeting tomorrow or he'll lose a lot more than money. Tell him Kamar called." I asked him to please spell his name. "K-A-M-A-R," he snapped. Then the phone banged down hard. Shaken by the call, I wrote a quick note to Sinbad about it and left it on the office desk. Kamar sounded Arabic to both Ed and me. This new call left us both even more uneasy, especially after the further rumors we had heard about his problems with overseas countries where it was said he had lost confiscated properties. He had already had those two long-range shootings, one of which had shattered his bedroom window, but he still refused to call the police. I told Ed about the call, and he felt it was none of our business and that we shouldn't get involved with Sinbad's personal problems. "None of our business. We're already involved, whether we like it or not," I shot back. "You've already had two supposed drunks put a rifle shot through your truck, and it could have been your head. And during the past several days, I've noticed with a binocular several cars slowing way down right by our gate, big cars and filled with men. They were still too far away for me to get any idea of who they were, but this whole business is beginning to give me the willies." We were interrupted by the sound of the entry gate's annunciators, bong, bong, and figured that would be Sinbad arriving for another steamy weekend with lady friend Ada. In scarcely 3 minutes, Sinbad was a wild driver. He'd screeched up the half-mile drive from the Valley Main Road and into the carport area. He stepped out, said his usual blunt hello, and immediately strode into his office. I could tell he was preoccupied with something, but I called Ada in her room to tell her that Mr. Amand had arrived. I then went about my daily routine. Within minutes, he called me into his office, looking deadly pale. "Tell me about this phone call," he said, holding up my note with a clearly shaking hand. "Well, there's nothing more to say, sir, except that the caller appeared to be very angry. He said you'd know who he was, and he said you'd better be at some kind of a meeting tomorrow, or else, as he put it," he interrupted me with an abrupt dismissal wave of a hand, saying sharply, "You are not to mention this to anyone, not Miss Longstreet, not anyone, understand?" I nodded and left, feeling even more shaken than before. Later, he and beautiful Ada left in her Mercedes convertible for another in-town dinner, saying they'd be back before midnight. At about 11 o'clock that evening, we heard a distant metallic crashing sound, like an automobile crash from down in the valley. But in the dark, I couldn't use the binoculars to check on where it had come from. But immediately we could hear the sound of a powerful motor roaring up the half-mile grade toward us. Someone had apparently crashed our gate and was coming, hell-bent, for the house. I turned off the lights in our place, and we both got down out of sight. "Damn," Ed muttered. "Why did we take Butch to the vet yesterday? We could sure use him now. This looks like trouble." And it was. A large, dark-colored van roared into the parking area behind the carport and screeched to a stop. We were peering in the dark from behind our curtains to see if we could make out who it was. But with the outside lights now off, there was little to see except for three or four dark shapes moving quickly through the carport down towards the house. We could hear brief, low-voiced exchanges between them, but we couldn't make out what was being said. I then realized I'd left the glass sliding doors of the house by the pool unlocked after Sinbad had left. Well, they immediately found the opening. We could hear thudding, a couple of crashes, then a loud banging, loud cursing and yelling from what seemed to be Sinbad's office. Oh, we both at that moment thought about the dull routine we had left at home, and now look where we were. I thought to myself, how did we ever get into this? First my leg disaster at Lingerwood, then Lulu's nightmare, now this, ye gods. At this moment, the phone rang, and someone in the house immediately picked it up. I dared to very gingerly pick up our extension, and I heard a guttural voice growling, "Well, the bastard's not here," and something unintelligible in a foreign language. Again, it sounded like Arabic. I very softly hung up the phone. Ed and I were terrified, but we dared not make a sound. In another few minutes, the bunch of intruders came back through the open carport door and paused briefly to bang heavily on our door. We were silent. When they heard nothing from inside, they continued out to their van and took off. We went immediately into the house to see what they had done to the place, and we found the office a shambles. His desk lamp was smashed in the floor with pencils and other debris scattered all around. File drawers were open with papers tossed everywhere. His custom-made leather recliner had a long, vicious slash in it from the top of the back down to the seat. Several of his wall plaques and pictures had been thrown against the wall and smashed. Then we noticed some sort of note in the middle of his desk written in again what looked like Arabic with a large felt pen. We couldn't read it, of course. We dared not call the police because of Sinbad's warnings, so we left things the way we found them and waited for his return. He and lady friend Ada arrived back from their dinner shortly before midnight, scarcely a half an hour after the invasion. We met them in the carport as they drove in and immediately told them what happened and that they had just missed the intruders by less than a half an hour. Both of them blanched at our story. We wondered what had happened to our gate as we came in, Ada said, as they quickly hurried into the house and surveyed the damage while we discreetly stayed in our place. Sinbad called us in on the intercom. "Please come in here, both of you," he requested in a shaky voice. Both he and Ada were sorting through the mess as we reached his office. I said, "At your request, we didn't call the police, but we were really frightened. We had all of our lights out, and we stayed hidden, crouched down until they left." Sinbad, his hands trembling, said, "Well, I'm glad you weren't hurt, but please tell me what you heard. Did you hear anything they said or what they wanted?" I told him about my sneaking a listen on our phone extension, but they appeared to be speaking a foreign language that could have been Arabic. "Arabic? How would you know anything about Arabic?" Sinbad asked. "Well, we've traveled extensively in the Middle East, and we've heard enough of it to recognize the inflections in some of the words." "Oh? Well, you're to say absolutely nothing about this to anyone, understand?" We both nodded. "I'll take care of this matter in my own way," he continued. He turned abruptly from us and put his arms around Ada, who had suddenly burst into tears. "Oh, I'm afraid, Aman," she sobbed. "I'm afraid for you and for all of us here." Sinbad then abruptly said to us over his shoulder, "Good night." It was anything but.
Well, we wish we had the time to relate more of our bizarre and sometimes shocking experiences, both here with Sinbad and Ada, and with two other ultra-wealthy families with whom we lived and worked for two more years. We could tell you about my incredible gaffe and my butlering duties at a posh dinner party, or about our inadvertently witnessing our employer's wild midnight poolside sexual escapade, or maybe tell you about Jackie's tough love approach to controlling a disturbed teenage boy whose care was unexpectedly dumped on us, or serving as psychotherapist for lovely Ada, or perhaps the elegant but frantic lawn party were attending ambassadors, judges, and other political potentates, and their elegantly attired wives were all routed in a wild bee-stinging assault, or my being shot at in my truck by two wild drunks, or dozens of other weird offbeat adventures. But time is running out.
That was Jacqueline and Ed Hibbler reading excerpts from their book of memoirs, which they entitled, Oh, Those Gutsy Geezers. Well, as we heard, it's never too late for people to experience all sorts of adventures. Here we heard about two retired professionals, both of whom had spent their careers in education, expecting to retire with a modicum of financial security when, because of some bad luck, their nest egg crumbled, leaving them totally destitute. But even at their advanced ages, they faced their misfortune head-on and secured some really unusual, difficult, and sometimes dangerous jobs as housekeepers, cooks, butlers, gardeners, and chauffeurs for some very wealthy and indeed eccentric people. At any rate, you have to give these gutsy geezers a lot of credit for not feeling sorry for themselves, for not whining, for not looking for a handout, but for having the initiative and guts, even at their advanced ages, to take on some jobs that a lot of younger folks would think twice about accepting. Folks, it's been my pleasure to have known Ed Hibbler before he passed away, since for many years he taught psychology at Fresno City College, where I worked. And, as we mentioned earlier, the two stories we heard tonight are excerpts from a book entitled Oh, Those Gutsy Geezers, that the two of them wrote. When he worked at Fresno City College, Ed Hibbler taught psychology and human sexuality. He even wrote a book based on his many years of teaching and the hundreds of anonymous questions he received during his teaching career. The book is entitled Sex, Sin, and Satisfaction in the Classroom. And so we come to the end of another segment of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. Next week, our writer reader will be Anne Marcella. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just get online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.